Mark Tramiel, let me get your thoughts on this, because I want to come back to something that Jim Conant said about evolutionary accounts. So let me ask you to talk a little bit more about whether you are interested primarily in looking at how people react to music or in coming up with an evolutionary account.
And I think that the two go hand in hand, and they do, of course, need to be discriminated. It's such a rich topic, Gretchen. I'm Kant comes to mind in this context, the notion that we're born with the machinery to make sense of the world around us. There's no question that our ability to recognize different, what we may call auditory objects. I think we all understand what that means when Bob talks about a table and how that's an object. But really, my voice, your voice, the sound of a guitar, the sound of a violin, the sound of a bird chirping, the sound of a lion roaring and coming and chasing you down your path, those are auditory objects. And our ability to process harmonic patterns is a key element of our ability to recognize auditory objects for what they are. This brings us to the next level in philosophy of thinking about semiotics, that what is the meaning of the sound? How does the sound convey that particular meaning? So what we try to do is to identify specific anatomical or chemical elements of the human brain that seem to be involved with that particular process, putting sound into meaning, and then depending on that meaning, the relationship to beauty and aesthetics is yet another stage of the processing system. If we could identify specific parts of the brain that are more or less dedicated to those different aspects of aesthetic experience, then we might be able to provide some biological proof for their existence.
Jim?
I thought that last step happened really fast. I think it's, certainly right that, the reason we have, there's got to be a neurophysiological and ultimately an evolutionary account of why we have the particular visual system we do and why we have the particular auditory system we do and why we can find certain things to be auditorily or visually significant and process them the way we do and so forth. It seems to me a complete non sequitur to conclude that analysis at that level will also give us an explanation of what we find aesthetically excellent or significant. That presupposes there are certain features of visually beautiful objects which we can just list, and then we'll say the explanation of why we find the beautiful features, the beautiful ones, is then to be sought at this other level. But I think even that first step in the argument is bound to fail. The history of aesthetics, even just with respect to the particular media, say painting or music, has involved one theory after another that tries to say a beautiful painting is a painting that does the following. And then immediately the next step in the history of art, if there is such a theorist, is for people to produce significant paintings that don't fit the theory. So I think it's very hard to say anything general about what makes things beautiful. I think that's almost internal to our concept of the beautiful, that it can't be formalized in a formula. I'll just say one more thing. I think if there's one general thing you can say about the different artistic media, it's that you can't tell in advance what will give significance to the possibilities of a given medium. Say painting, just by thinking about the materials out of which it's made or the possibilities of combination they allow. Say paint and canvas. Say paint and canvas. Such possibilities are discovered in the history of an art, and they involve a relationship between the artist and his art in that particular period in art. And the idea that we can come up with some formula and say, here are the beautiful properties of these objects, and then here's the feature of our visual system that allows us to select for those features, I think already involves a kind of repression of what art is.
But it's not so much a repression, it's a constraint, Jim. The lack of popularity of microtonal music over the past 50 to 100 years is not a coincidence. It's interesting. One can listen to it. It's certainly art, and it is certainly high-level music. However, nobody likes it.
Right, but if
And part of the issue there is that there are these global aspects of perceptual processing and then more local aspects of perceptual processing. Unquestionably, and music is such a wonderful example for this, what is aesthetically pleasing in the music of one culture is not necessarily aesthetically pleasing. And the mystery behind that, I would agree with you wholeheartedly, has yet to be solved.
Jim?
But there are some biological constraints. There is a reason why all of the cultures in the world structure their music around octaves. What they do within that octave varies greatly from culture to culture, and that would bring us to the issue of mental structures and the role of expectancies in the generation of cognitive perceptual schemata like tension-relaxation schema. That's a whole nother level, I think, that you're getting at, which is such a beautifully infinite degree of variability for humans, but it is rooted to some extent within the biological machinery that we enter the world with.